You're listening to Nick Treadwell's Storyville. Chapter 6. There is a place in front of the Royal Exchange where the wide pavement reaches out like a promontory. It is the shape of a triangle with a rounded apex. A stream of traffic runs on either side, and other streets send their currents down into the open space before it. Like the spokes of a wheel converging, streams of human life flow into this agitated pool. Horses and carriages, carts, vans, omnibuses, cabs, every kind of conveyance cross each other's course in every possible direction, twisting in and out by the wheels and under the horses' heads, working a devious way. Men and women of all conditions wind a path over. They fill the indices between the carriages and blacken the surface till the vans almost float on human beings. Now the streams slacken, and now they rush amain, but never cease. Dark waves are always rolling down the incline opposite. Waves swell out from the side rivers. All London converges into this focus. There is an indistinguishable noise. It is not clatter, hum or roar. It is not resolvable. Made up of 1,000,000 footsteps from 1,000 hooves, 1,000 wheels of haste and shuffle and quick movements and ponderous loads, no attention can resolve it into a fixed sound. Blue carts and yellow omnibuses, varnished carriages and brown vans, green omnibuses and red cabs, pale loads of yellow straw, rusty red iron clanking on paintless carts, high white wool packs, grey horses, bay horses, black teams, sunlight sparkling on brass harness, gleaming from carriage panels, jingle, jingle, jingle. And intermixed and intertangled, ceaselessly changing jingle too, of colour, flecks of colour, champed, as it were, like bits in the horse's teeth, frothed and strewn about, and a surface always of dark-dressed people winding like the curves of fast-flowing water. This is the vortex and whirlpool, the centre of human life today on earth. Now the tide rises and now it sinks, but the flow of these rivers always continues. Here it seethes and whirls, not for an hour only, but for all present time, hour by hour, day by day, year by year. Here it rushes and pushes, the atoms triturate and grind and, eagerly thrusting by, pursue their separate ends. Here it appears in its unconcealed personality, indifferent to all else but itself, absorbed and wrapped in eager self, devoid and stripped of conventional gloss and politeness, yielding only to get its own way, driving, pushing, carried on in a stress of feverish force like a bullet, dynamic force apart from reason or will, like the force that lifts the tides and sends the clouds onwards. The friction of 1,000 interests evolves a condition of electricity in which men are moved to and fro without considering their steps. Yet the agitated pool of life is stonily indifferent. The thought is absent or preoccupied, for it is evident that the mass are unconscious of the scene in which they act. But it is more sternly real than the very stones, for all these men and women that pass through are driven on by the push of accumulated circumstances. They cannot stay, they must go. Their necks are in the slaves' ring, they are beaten like seaweed against the solid walls of fact. In ancient times, Xerxes, the king of kings, looking down upon his myriads, wept to think that in 100 years not one of them would be left. Where will be these millions of today in 100 years? But further than that, let us ask, where then will be the sum and outcome of their labour? If they wither away like the summer grass, will not at least a result be left which those of 100 years hence may be the better for? No. Not one jot. There will not be any sum or outcome or result of this ceaseless labour and movement. It vanishes in a moment that it is done, and in 100 years nothing will be there, for nothing is there now. there will be no more sum or result than accumulates from the motion of a revolving cowl on a housetop, nor do they receive any more sunshine during their lives, for they are unconscious of the sun. I used to come and stand near the apex of the promontory of pavement which juts out towards the pool of life. I still go there to ponder. Burning in the sky, the sun shone on me as when I rested in the narrow valley carved in prehistoric time. Burning in the sky, I can never forget the sun. The heat of the summer is dry there, as if the light carried an impalpable dust, dry, breathless heat that will not let the skin respire, but swathes up the dry fire in the blood. But beyond the heat and light, I felt the presence of the sun as I felt it in the solitary valley, the presence of the resistless forces of the universe. The sun burned in the sky as I stood and pondered. Is there any theory, philosophy or creed? Is there any system or culture, any formulated method able to meet and satisfy each separate item of this agitated pool of human life, by which they may be guided, by which hope, by which look forward? Not a mere illusion of the craven heart, something real as the solid walls of fact against which, like drifted seaweed, they are dashed. Something to give each separate personality sunshine and a flower in its own existence now. Something to shape this million-handed labour to an end and outcome that will leave more sunshine and more flowers to those who must succeed? Something real now and not in the spirit land. In this hour, now, as I stand and the sun burns, can any creed, philosophy, system or culture endure the test and remain unmolten in this fierce focus of human life? Consider. Is there anything slowly painted on the once mystic and now commonplace papyri of ancient Egypt held on the mummy's withered breast, in that elaborate ritual, in the procession of the symbols, in the winged circle, in the laborious sarcophagus? Nothing, absolutely nothing. Before the fierce heart of the human furnace, the papyri smoulder away as paper smoulders under the lens in the sun. Remember Nineveh and the cult of the fir cone, the turbaned and bearded bulls of stone, the lion hunt, the painted chambers loaded with tile books, the lore of the arrow-headed writing. What is Assyria? There are sand and failing rivers in Assyria's writings and utter nothing. The aged caves of India, who shall tell when they were sculptured? Far back when the sun was burning in the sky as now in untold precedent time. Is there any meaning in those ancient caves? The indistinguishable noise not to be resolved, born of the human struggle, mocks in answer. In the strange characters of the Zend, in the Sanskrit, in the effortless creeds of Confucius, in the Aztec coloured string writings and rayed stones, in the uncertain marks left of the sunken Polynesian continent, hieroglyphs are useless as those of Memphis. Nothing, nothing. They have been tried and were found an illusion. Think then, today, now, looking from this apex of the pavement, premonitory outwards from our own land to the utmost bounds of the farthest sail, is there any faith or culture at this hour which can stand in this fierce heat? From the various forms of Semitic, Aryan or Turanian creed now existing, from the printing press to the palm leaf volume onto those who call on the jewel in the lotus, can aught be gathered which can face this, the reality, the indistinguishable noise, non-resolvable, roars aloud contempt. Turn, then, to the calm reasoning of Aristotle. Is there anything in that? Can the half-divine thought of Plato rising in stories of sequential ideas following each other to the conclusion endure here? No. All the philosophers of Diogenes, Laertius fade away. The theories of medieval days, the organon of experiment, down to this hour, they are useless alike. The science of this hour, drawn from the printing press to an endless web of paper, is powerless here. The indistinguishable noise echoed from the smoke-shadowed walls despises the whole. 1,000 footsteps, 1,000 hooves, 1,000 wheels roll over and utterly condemn them in complete annihilation. Mere illusions of heart or mind, they are tested and thrust aside by the irresistible push of 1,000,000 converging feet. Burning in the sky, the sun shines as it shone on me in the solitary valley, as it burned on when the earliest cave of India was carved. Above the indistinguishable roar of the many feet, I feel the presence of the sun, of the immense forces of the universe, and beyond these, the sense of the eternal now, of the immortal. Full well aware that all has failed, yet side by side with the sadness of that knowledge, there lives on in me an unquenchable belief, thought burning like the sun, that there is yet something to be found, something real, something to give each separate personality sunshine and flowers in its own existence now, something to shape this 1,000,000-handed labour to an end and outcome, leaving accumulated sunshine and flowers to those who shall succeed. It must be dragged forth by might of thought from the immense forces of the universe. To prepare for such an effort, first, the mind must be cleared of the conceit that, because we live today, we are wiser than the ages gone. The mind must acknowledge its ignorance. All the learning and lore of so many eras must be erased from it as an encumbrance. It is not from past or present knowledge, science or faith that it is to be drawn. Erase these altogether, as they are erased under the fierce heat of the focus before me. Begin wholly afresh, go straight to the sun, the immense forces of the universe, to the entity unknown, go higher than a god, deeper than prayer, and open a new day, that I might but have a fragment of Caesar's intellect to find a fragment of this desire. From my home near London, I made a pilgrimage almost daily to an aspen by the brook. It was 1.25 miles along the road, far enough for me to walk off the concentration of mind necessary for work. The idea of the pilgrimage was to get away from the endless and nameless circumstances of everyday existence, which by degrees build a wall around the mind so that it travels in a constantly narrowing circle. This tether of the faculties tends to make them accept present knowledge and present things as all that can be attained to. This is all. There is nothing more. Is the iterated preaching of house life. Remain. Be content. Go round and round in one barren path. A little money, a little food and sleep, some ancient fables, old age and death. Of all the inventions of causatory with man for ages, has in various ways which manacled himself and stayed his own advance, there is none equally potent with the supposition that nothing more is possible. Once well impress on the mind that it has already all, that advance is impossible because there is nothing further, and it is chained like a horse to an iron pin in the ground. It is the most deadly, the most fatal poison of the mind. No such causatory has ever for a moment held me. But still, if permitted, the constant routine of house life, the same work, the same thought in the work, the little circumstances regularly reoccurring will dull the keenest edge of thought. By my daily pilgrimage, I escaped from it back to the sun. In summer, the leaves of the aspen rustled pleasantly. There was the tinkle of falling water over a hatch. Thrushes sang and blackbirds whistled. Green finches laughed in their talk to each other. The commonplace dusty road was commonplace no longer. In the dust was the mark of the chaffinch's little feet. The white light rendered even the dust brighter to look on. The air came from the southwest. There were distant hills in that direction, over fields of grass and corn. As I visited the spot from day to day, the wheat grew from the green to yellow, the wild roses flowered, the scarlet poppies appeared, and again the beeches reddened in autumn. In the march of time there fell away from my mind, as the leaves from the trees in autumn, the last traces and relics of superstitions and traditions acquired compulsory in childhood, always feebly adhering, they finally disappeared. There fell away, too, personal bias and prejudice, enabling me to see clearer and with wider sympathies. The glamour of modern science and discoveries faded away, for I found them no more than the first potter's wheel. Erasure and reception proceeded together. The past accumulations of causatory were erased, and my thought widened to receive the idea of something beyond all previous ideas. With disbelief, belief increased. The aspiration and hope, the prayer, was the same as that which I felt years before on the hills, only it now broadened. Experience of life, instead of curtailing and checking my prayer, led me to reject experience altogether. As well might the horse believe that the road the bridle forces it to traverse every day encircles the earth, as I believe in experience. All the experience of the greatest city in the world could not withhold me. I rejected it wholly. I stood bareheaded before the sun, in the presence of the earth and air, in the presence of the immense forces of the universe. I demanded that which will make me more perfect now, this hour. London convinced me of my own thought. That thought has always been with me and grows wider. One midsummer I went out of the road into the fields and sat down on the grass between the yellowing wheat and the green hawthorn bushes. The sun burned in the sky. The wheat was full of a luxuriant sense of growth, the grass high, the earth giving its vigour to tree and leaf, the heaven blue. The vigour and growth, the warm and light, the beauty and richness of it entered into me. An ecstasy of soul accompanied the delicate excitement of the senses. The soul rose with the body, wrapped in the fullness of the moment. I prayed there with all that expansion of mind and frame. No words, no definition, inexpressible desire of physical life, of soul life, equal to and beyond the highest imagining of my heart. These memories cannot be placed in exact chronological order. There was a time when a weary restlessness came upon me, perhaps from too long continued labour. It was like a drought, a moral drought, as if I had been absent for many years from the sources of life and hope. The inner nature was faint, all was dry and tasteless. I was weary for the pure, fresh springs of thought. Some instinctive feeling, uncontrollable, drove me to the sea. I was so under its influence that I could not arrange the journey so as to get the longest day. I merely started and, of course, had to wait and endure much inconvenience. To get to the sea at some quiet spot was my one thought. To do so, I had to travel farther, and from want of prearrangement, it was between 2 and 3 in the afternoon before I reached the end of my journey. Even then, being too much preoccupied to inquire the way, I missed the road and had to walk a long distance before coming to the shore. But I found the sea at last. I walked beside it in a trance, away from the houses, out into the wheat. The ripe corn stood up to the beach, the waves on one side of the shingle, and the yellow wheat on the other. There alone, I went down to the sea. I stood where the foam came to my feet and looked out over the sunlit waters. The great earth, bearing the richness of the harvest and its hills golden with corn, was at the back, its strength and firmness under me. The great sun shone above. The wide sea was before me. The wind came sweet and strong from the waves. The life of the earth and the sea. The glow of the sun filled me. I touched the surge with my hand. I lifted my face to the sun. I opened my lips to the wind. I prayed aloud in the roar of the waves. My soul was strong as the sea and prayed with the sea's might. Give me fullness of life like to the sea and the sun. to the earth and the air. Give me fullness of physical life, mind equal and beyond their fullness. Give me a greatness and perfection of soul higher than all things. Give me my inexpressible desire, which swells in me like a tide. Give it to me with all the force of the sea. Then I rested, sitting by the wheat. The bank of beach was between me and the sea, but the waves beat against it. The sea was there, the sea was present and at hand. By the dry wheat I rested. I did not think I was inhaling the richness of the sea. All the strength and the depth of meaning of the sea and earth came to me again. I rubbed out some of the wheat in my hands. I took up a piece of clod and crumbled it in my fingers. It was a joy to touch it. I held my hands so that I could see the sunlight gleam on the slightly moist surface of the skin. The earth and sun were to me like my flesh and blood, and the air of the sea life. With all the greater existence I drew from them, I prayed for a bodily life equal to it, for a soul life beyond my thought, for my inexpressible desire for more than I could shape even into idea. There was something higher than idea, invisible to thought, as air to the eye. Give me bodily life equal in fullness to the strength of earth and sun and sea. Give me the soul life of my desire. Once more I went down to the sea, touched it, and said farewell. So deep was the inhalation of this life that day that it seemed to remain in me for years. This was a real pilgrimage. Time passed away, with more labour, pleasure, and again at last, after much pain and weariness of mind, I came down again to the sea. The circumstances were changed. It was not a hurried glance. There were opportunities for longer thought. It mattered scarcely anything to me now, whether I was alone or whether houses and other people were near. Nothing could disturb my inner vision. By the sea, aware of the sun overhead and the blue heaven, I feel that there is nothing between me and space. This is the verge of a gulf, and a tangent from my feet goes straight unchecked into the unknown. It is the edge of an abyss, as much as if the earth were cut away in a sheer fall of 8,000 miles to the sky beneath, hence a hollow to the stars. Looking straight out is looking straight down. The eye glance gradually departs from the sea level, and rising as that falls, enters the hollow of heaven. It is gazing along the face of a vast precipice into the hollow space which is nameless. There mystery has been placed, but realizing the vast hollow yonder makes me feel that the mystery is here. I, who am here on the verge, standing on the margin of the sky, am in the mystery myself. If I let my eye look back upon me from the extreme opposite of heaven, then this spot where I stand is in the center of the hollow. Alone with the sea and sky, I presently feel all the depth of wonder of the unknown come back surging up around and touching me as the foam runs to my feet. I am in it now, not tomorrow, this moment. I cannot escape from it. Though I may deceive myself with labour, yet still I am in it, in sleep too. There is no escape from this immensity. Feeling this by the sea, under the sun, my life enlarges and quickens, striving to take to itself the largeness of the heaven. The frame cannot expand, but the soul is able to stand before it. No giant's body could be in proportion to the earth, but a little spirit is equal to the entire cosmos, to earth and ocean, sun and star hollow. There are but a few acres in it, where the cosmos twice as wide, the soul could run over it and return to itself in a time so small, no measure exists to meet it. Therefore, I think the soul may sometimes find out an existence as superior as mind is to the dead chalk cliff. With the great sun burning over the foam-flaked sea, roofed with heaven, aware of myself, a consciousness forced on me by these things, I feel that thought must yet grow larger and correspond in magnitude of conception to these, but these cannot content me, these titanic things of sea, and sun, and profundity. I feel that my thought is stronger than they are. I burn like a torch. The hot light shot back from the sea scorches my cheek. My life is burning in me. The soul throbs like the sea for a larger life. No thought which I have ever had has satisfied my soul. Thanks for listening to this episode of Nick Treadwell's Storyville. Please subscribe if you liked what you heard, and be sure to check out my Substack blog, Letters from Storyville, at nicktreadwell.substack.com.